able to bilocate. He was seen teaching on the same day in Metapontum and at Torremaninum in Sicily, whatever that means. But that's been recorded of even of Catholic saints. There was one, I forget her name, who used to teach in the New World at the same time as she was living in Spain. Figure it out for yourself. I love these stories, no problem. He was good with animals, like many other sages. He's shown here in Montfaucon's rather charming engraving with the Dornian bear, the bear which he persuaded to stop eating people and eat a vegetarian diet instead. He once told an ox not to eat beans. I'm not going to get into the beans. Nobody has explained why Pythagoras forbade beans and what that meant. It seems extremely stupid for a vegetarian to me, but he must have had his reasons, or it was just symbolic. So the mythical side of him, the magical side of him, which again Walter Burkhardt associates with shamanism, he sees him as influenced by the shamanist traditions from the north. And this might be the Hyperborean influence that's mentioned in many of the legends. Here's Rubens' painting of Pythagoras, telling people to enjoy a vegetarian diet, which for Rubens is an excuse to paint one of his favorite kinds of image in the middle. But that was one of the things that most marked Pythagoreans in their society. A peculiarity of diet always sets people apart, and this has set the Pythagoreans apart. Now, we move from these mythical and legendary and rather mysterious things to the more side of Pythagoras, which is, I think, quite special to him. You don't find this kind of teaching in the other 6th century sages that we met at the beginning. And it all begins with the Tetractes, which for him was a figure, a divine figure, by which he would swear his oaths, and regarded as really the highest form of existence, number being the basis of both the spiritual and the material universe. The Tetractes is it survives today in Italian schools. It's called the Tavola Pythagorica, the Pythagoric table, and it's just a multiplication table with the numbers of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 along the two axes, and then their products in between. And so it's a way of learning the multiplication table. That's the plainest and most exoteric side of it. But Theon of Smyrna, writing admittedly a long time after Pythagoras, says that the Tetractes has at least 10 other meanings than this one. He says that it's not just the series of whole numbers, but you could write the powers of 2 along the one axis and the powers of 3 along the other axis. So down the left it would go 1, 2, 4, 8, down the right it would go 1, 3, 9, 27. And this, as some of you probably recognize, is the diagram of the lambda with which Timaeus in the Pythagorean, in the Platonic dialogue of that name, describes the making of the world soul through a sort of Tetractes with those powers of 2 and powers of 3, then filling them in musical terms. To go on with what Theon says, he says there's a sort of Tetractes of plane geometry, reading downwards, the point, the line, the surface, and the solid. There's a Tetractes of solid geometry, the first four regular solids, often called the Pythagorean solids, usurped by the Platonists, of course, who call them the Platonic solids, that being the tetrahedron, the cube, the octahedron, and the icosahedron, of which you're going to hear much more this week. Another Tetractes, the four elements, earth, water, air and fire. Another one, the vegetative world, the way everything grows from seed to stalk to leaf to the complete plant, which also is from point to line, from surface to solid. In society, man, a house, a street, and a city, Leon says, is what makes up a civilization. Then in the human being, the four types of knowledge, the pure intellectual knowledge, the knowledge gained from science, the knowledge gained from the senses, from opinion, and then lastly the sense knowledge, and the four parts of the human being, the three souls, that being the rational soul, the appetitive soul, the instinctive soul, and the body. How many have we got through? I think there's a couple more. The four seasons. The four seasons. If we apply this to time, time works in the Tetraktis. Spring, summer, autumn, winter. And the four seasons of human life. Infancy, youth, maturity, and old age. So these are the ones Theon gives as Tetraktis, whatever the plural is. I don't know much Greek. And with this we have, of course, the whole system of correspondences, which is absolutely essential to the Western or to any other esoteric tradition. To say that these four things are these four levels manifest in all these different walks of life, levels of being, is to say that the universe is constructed on such principles that shine forth just about everywhere you look. This, of course, is what even my taxi driver said. He knew about Pythagoras' theorem. And he didn't invent it. He brought it probably from Babylon, maybe from Egypt. It was common knowledge in those civilizations. But it bore his name because he brought it to Greece. And with that and his other mathematical inputs really founded the Greek mathematical school, as did his a knowledge of these solids, which I've mentioned already, the tetrahedron, cube, octahedron, icosahedron, and the dodecahedron, which again appear in the Timaeus dialogue, aligned with the four elements plus the ether. Something brief on Pythagoras and music. In my workshop, I shall go much more into this. Here we go to the legends again. Pythagoras was one day passing by a forge, and he stopped to listen to the noise that the hammers were making on the anvil, because he noticed that they were making a consonance. They were making the intervals of an octave, a fourth, a fifth, with the lowest one. So, bom, 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 bom. Those are the notes of the hammers. So he said, is it the anvil that does it? Is it how hard you hit it? What's making this? And he decided the difference was in the hammers. He tested other things. He realized that the hammers were all different weights. So he took them home. This is Robert Flood's book on the microcosm, blown out from something about half an inch high, showing Pythagoras coming in, part of Flood's Temple of Music. He took them home and he weighed them. There he is on the right weighing them, and behind him is Tubal Cain, the biblical figure who is the inventor of metallurgy and of music, or instrumental music. He took them home and he hung them on a monochord, or it must have been a tetrachord, I suppose, if there were four hammers, and he found that the four hammers caused the four strings to make the same tones. Bom, 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 bom. That's the legend. There's a fallacy there, but we won't stress that at the moment. So there's the monochord. His primary scientific device, his experimental tool, is a string, a sounding string, a measurable string, from which you can deduce here. We'll return to that in a moment. But the epicyclic hypothesis of planetary motion. Apparently, for most of the scientists of his day, all the stars and planets were on the same plane, on the same surface, and the planets just moved randomly around, which is why they get their name, which means wanderers. And their motions seem rather inexplicable because they go backwards, you may know, retro relations and so on. Pythagoras is credited with studying these motions and showing that they all come from combinations of perfect circles, and that the planets are not all on the same plane, but they are, as it were, the layers of an onion around the Earth. They are spaced out from the Earth, and that according to musical intervals. So there's a diagram showing from the Earth's point of view, a planet can seem to go backwards against the background of the zodiac, when actually it's just performing a little circle in the course of this big circle around the Earth. But did it go around the Earth or did it go around the Sun? Philolaus, Pythagoras' pupil, seems to have been a heliocentrist, and certainly in the Copernican era, Pythagoreanism was seen as a precedent for the heliocentric cosmology. And in the, going back to Robert Fludd, in this rather beautiful elaboration of one of his famous engravings, you can see the ambiguity. At the bottom is the Earth. So exoterically, the Earth is at the center of things, and then Earth, air, Earth, water, air, fire, and then the seven planetary spheres around it, Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and then the nine orders of angels, then the hand of God tuning the whole caboodle, and all imagined as being circular, you see, around the Earth. But esoterically, the Sun is pretty conspicuously at the middle of that thing, and Fludd has actually drawn a circle around it like that, which may mean that he too had an idea of an alternative, maybe spiritual rather than physical cosmos centered on the Sun. There's debate about what the Pythagorean cosmology really was, but as always, the sources are hundreds of years after Pythagoras, and they may just reflect later developments and later opinions. In any case, none of this stuff was really new. You must realize Pythagoras was not an inventor, he was a synthesizer. There's the 3-4-5 triangle in a much earlier manifestation in the second pyramid of Giza. Here's a more complicated Pythagorean triangle. Pythagorean triangles are right angle triangles which can be expressed by three whole numbers, and the number of them is this, 12, 35, 37. And that's from Alexander Thom's book on megalithic sites in Britain, showing how this Pythagorean triangle here, 12 by 35 by 37, gives the points from which this Woodhenge, the sacred site, is planned. Woodhenge, it's near Stonehenge. It's called Woodhenge because it wasn't built of stone. It's only detectable because of the post holes which held wooden posts. And there are many of them in many different circles. It's quite mysterious. But Thom was the Oxford professor of engineering who worked out the likely geometry behind these and how extremely complex and knowing it was. And he found that Pythagorean triangles was at the basis of many of them. But this is, what, 1,000 years before Pythagoras? I don't know how early it is. Also from Britain, these spheres, which turn up in the bottom drawers of archaeological museums as ritual objects or something, on examination they turn out to be globular representations of the five regular solids. So again, 1,000 years or more before Pythagoras, somebody had worked out these regular divisions of the sphere and was expressing them sometimes in a rather beautiful way with engraved spirals, sometimes like that, simply with knobs instead of props, but they're the same the same division of the spherical body. Getting back into the linguistic underworld, just take the word tetraktes. Some of you may know Greek gematria, in which every letter has a numerical value. In fact, the Greek letters were the Greek ways of writing number. And you add up the letters of tetraktes, and my goodness, it comes to 1, 2, 3, 4. Now don't tell me that's a fluke. The word is obviously designed to embody the diagram itself. I don't know how many of you have studied Ernest Maclean's writings, the Myth of Invariance, the Pythagorean Plato, the Meditations through the Quran, in which he shows that there's a musical canon that was shared by all these ancient civilizations. And in this particular one, he shows how, beginning with something like a tetraktes, like at the top of here is like a tetraktes, you extend it, you mirror it, and in a process that I'm not going to go into here, you come out with a bunch of letters and a bunch of numbers, of which the limiting one is 25920, which is the traditional number of years in the cycle of the precession of the equinoxes. Now, how about Pythagoras' own name? He said there was something special about his name. I said earlier it was given him by his parents to commemorate the Delphic oracle's prediction of his birth. Well, it comes up to 864. And this is from Jean Michel, my dear friend, one of the wisest men of our time, from his book, The Pythagorean, his book, The City of Revelation. On first sight, I'm pressing the wrong button. Bummer. It says, and there we go. It says angle, square, or corner. So there's the Pythagorean theorem in a nutshell. That's what his name says first. But then in Greek gematria, these are some of the other meanings that John Michel has dug out. Hagion of the saints, ends up to 864. Thronos Avraxon, Praxis, 864. And then in Michel's exploration of this canon, a lot of it has to do with the New Jerusalem in the Book of Revelation and the measurements on it. In the British traditional measurements of acres, feet, and miles, 8,640 acres. The number of seconds in a day, you can't argue with that. The diameter of the sun in miles. How did they know that? Take Michel on his own as his own witness. And the day and night of Brahma in the Hindu temporal system, 864, all those zeros. So that I would say that keys his name in with a numerical, philosophical, cosmological system of which we only have the slightest inkling through people like John Michel and Ernest Maclean. We're only just beginning. These are the tips of icebergs. And if anybody will ever put the whole thing together, I don't know. Each one is a specialist. Michel didn't know music, so he couldn't do what Maclean did. Was not interested in geometry, so he couldn't do what Michel did. But both of them go back and they find these symptoms of the same numerical canon in all these prehistoric civilizations.
I'm sorry, I missed what the second one is. What the meaning
is. Hagion of the saints. But it's the genitive plural of Hagios.
What does that mean?
Well, it's found in compounds, you know, the glory of the saints, that's just Pythagorean metaphysics, if you start with the detractors, of course there's one at the top, the one which is both infinite and single, and then you come down and the next level is two. Aristotle gives these, and this is a very early witness to the Pythagorean beliefs, that they classified the universe into opposites, and those are 10 of the opposites. Now, what's meant by an opposite? Does this mean that the unlimited is bad, that the female is oblong, that the many are on the left? No. I think it means that it should be complementary. That would have been a better word. But to make a universe, the one has got to split. It's got to split into the many. But they're not antagonists, they're complements. The right is not superior to the left, or vice versa. You need both of them in order to orient yourself in space. You need both male and female. You need both light and darkness. And for many of these, there's a sliding scale between good and bad. Well, some people's bad is other people's good, and vice versa. There's no absolute evil in the Pythagorean doctrine. There couldn't possibly be. It's just degrees of the way we experience things as good or bad.
Isn't it the analysis with yin and yang?
Yes, yin and yang, exactly. Each containing a spot of the other. Yes, it's the exactly.
Which is older, I think, actually, in time?
Yin yang, well, it's Taoist, isn't it? So anyway, back with Lao Tzu in the 6th century. Yes, if he invented it. I think probably like Pythagoras, he's drawing on much more ancient things too. But yeah, thank you. Sometimes it gets moralized, and in later writings, they said that Pythagoras' teaching was that life is like the letter epsilon, which is written in its capital form like a capital Y. And here you have the people who go up the left-hand column, nicely dressed with a candle, and at the top of it, this is the idea of, I couldn't find the source of this, but obviously a 16th century idea of what people really want, which is a leg of lamb on a spit, a jug of wine, bread, sausages, and a roast chicken. And of course he eats them all and then falls down into the fires of hell. But if you go up a narrow path, which is thorny, you see the woman here going out crawling with difficulty, assailed by terrible beasts as she goes, and then at the top of it she meets the throne of wisdom. But she's starting from the barren land. Anyway. That's the idea. There to go in any situation. And the easy one is probably the wrong one.
One before, sorry.
Yes.
You mentioned 10 opposites. Was it limited to 10, or was it just an example?
Aristotle gives 10.
Oh, right.
Seems significant, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Theon gives 10 practices. Later on, yes. Things tend to go in tens.
Right.
Yeah. I didn't even mention, but the detractors has 10 dots, of course. Yeah. What did the Pythagoreans do? Well, we can't just talk about this for forever, but this is a wonderful picture by a Russian romantic painter of them greeting the sun. They were worshippers of the sun and the manifestation of the one. They were exoteric and esoteric in different circles. And they tried to live a virtuous life, especially of recollection, which I suppose is the beginning of self-knowledge. Their prime practice seems to have been to remember all their deeds of the day at the end of the day, and to predict all their deeds of the next day, and to measure one against the other to see how they succeeded. So noted to say our tongue, words of the Delphic Oracle, know thyself seems to be the first requirement. But then there are all the other teachings of mathematics and theology and... So... After Pythagoras' time, he is known as... I won't tell his history of how the Pythagoreans got involved in politics and how they got drummed out of one place and finally practically extinguished, and then they migrated to Greece and Sicily and so on. But in his later reputation, here's another set of 10. Diogenes Laertes said that the Pythagorean first, the things he was first to do, and it's a funny list, which shows how his activity and his teaching ranged over all human behavior. He was the first to say that friends are equals. He was the first to say that friends share their property in common. He was the first to train athletes by giving them a diet of meat. He was the first to teach that the soul comes back into different bodies. He was the first to introduce weights and measures among the Greeks. He was the first to identify the morning star with the evening star, which the planet Venus. He was the first to teach boxing in a scientific manner. He was the first to call the universe a cosmos, which is the same root as we get cosmetics from, something beautiful, something comely. And he was the first to teach that the earth is round. So, everything from boxing to athletes to metaphysics to a principle of coexistence, and the principle of universal friendship, which the Pythagoreans tried to practice, but found they couldn't do it with the world as a whole, and had to resort to practicing it within themselves. Those are some of the things for which we remember. And his native island honored him with a coin, showing him with his hand. I'm sorry, this seems to have run out, its battery has died, or it doesn't go on anymore. But you can hear me without it, can't you? No?
Yes.
It shows him with his hat on the run, on the run sphere of the earth and of the heavens. So, after Pythagoras, just checking the time, because I must go on beyond the talking break. Yes, we've not advanced after Pythagoras yet. So, to take a bit of a leap, thank you. To take a bit of a leap, we come to the Neopythagoreans. There seems to be a Neopythagorean revival in the first century BC. Numenius is the name associated with it, and he led a Neopythagorean cult in Rome. And we don't know much about what they did, except they tried to lead a Pythagorean life. But in 1917, when they were doing excavations near the main, near the Porta Maggiore in Rome for the underground, they found this underground temple. It hadn't been underground originally, I don't think. It's just that the surface of the ground had risen through perpetual buildings. But they found this basilica, and on studying its decorations, it was thought to have been a Pythagorean meeting place, because the decorations have stuccos of symbols of the soul's migration. A symbol, for example, of the poetess Sappho throwing herself off the Leucadian cliff, which the Pythagoreans interpreted as the soul releasing itself from the body into space. And semi-human beings, journeys across the sea, nymphs, Dionysian emblems and so on. So it seems that there was a Pythagorean cult going on in Rome at the same time.
And more surprisingly,
we have Philo Judaeus, a contemporary of this, a learned Jew
who tried to reconcile
his native faith with Platonism and Pythagoreanism in ways such as interpreting the 7 days of creation in a Pythagorean way by finding all the other sevenfold symbols to the point almost of deifying the numbers as much as one could do and still remain a monotheist. Or saying that Moses could hear the harmony of the spheres and compose songs at every moment. So making Moses a kind of proto-Pythagoras in himself. Trying to reconcile Judaism and Platonism, there's three images of how Philo is seen by later artists. The Pythagorean studies, as we can see now, center around arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. And these, in the hands of the late Roman encyclopedists, became the quadrivium, the four-part scientific study that's part of the four of the seven liberal arts, the others being grammar, logic, and rhetoric. So, arithmetic, here we have a much later 13th century picturing of it, with Pythagoras shown here. Here he's associated with arithmetic. And he's got a Pythagorean tetractes, or developed Pythagorean table, with 1, 2, 4, 8, 16 along one axis, and 1, 9. I'm not sure, I can't read those. 7, 8, 12. Yeah, powers of 2 and the powers of 3 there. We have geometry with the Vesica Pisces there. We have music with the measuring of the monochord into its four concords, and we have astronomy, Ptolemy, who is thought to be the king of Egypt. So those became the foundation of medieval education, and really kept being studied right through the 18th century from the medieval sources. Euclid, geometry, Boethius in music, like arithmetic, and Ptolemy in astronomy. What happened to them? Well, I haven't talked about the Neoplatonists. I can't fit everything in here, but I think this is a very important and interesting sideline. In 529, the Emperor Justinian banned all the pagan schools from teaching. They'd survived almost 200 years of a Christianized Roman Empire, but finally the doors were shut. The Athenian Academy was closed down, and the last Platonic philosophers, Damascus and Simplicius, took refuge in the court of Persia, where they were welcomed. And it's suggested that they were at the basis of the Pythagorean tradition by the Islamic scientists, that they were somehow the progenitors of a very interesting cult at Havan or Karai in southeast Turkey, which took Hermes Trismegistus as its preceptor and had a cult of the worship of the seven planets. And when the Muslim conquerors came along, they said they were quite orthodox because Hermes Trismegistus was the same as Idris, who is the prophet Enoch. And so they managed to survive the Muslim conquests and continue their studies of these quadrivial matters. These are the ruins of Haran. And then they seem to have passed the torch to the Brethren of Purity in southern Iraq, in Basra, who compiled, around the year 1000, compiled a 52-volume encyclopedia that gathered all the Greco-Roman knowledge, all the quadrivial knowledge, particularly with a book on music, a book on the powers of music, a book on the cosmology of music that are purely Pythagorean. So it may be that the line goes straight from ancient Athens, the end of the Athenian school, and then fertilizing the whole Persian movement that Henry Corbin has studied, and then goes into these rather fringe Islamic movements, and then fertilizes Islamic science, which, as you probably know, is all based on Greek science, and preserves it through the dark ages of Christianity, where it surfaces again in the High Gothic era. Here's Pythagoras as one of the representations of the seven liberal arts while Paul Charles writing, presumably doing arithmetic. It's hard to know what he's doing, I think he's writing. But I think these are little bells hanging on a wall there to show that he was calculating musical intervals. There he is on the Doge's palace, and here says, here says Pythagoras ars metrica. And there's Euclid, I can't read that, but the art of measurement, measuring it on. But remember that he also weights and measures to the Greeks. So he's seen as the person who applies mathematics. And in Venice, at that time, of course, it would be to a calculation of profits and losses and double-engine bookkeeping. There he is in Germany, in Nuremberg, on the fountain in central Nuremberg, again as one of the liberal arts, playing a kind of elementary lyre, dressed as a medieval Jean Verne. Here he is with his pupil Philolaus, and Eubal too, who I mentioned as the biblical originator of metallurgy and music. He's experimenting with bells there, which he isn't recorded of doing in the ancient texts, with musical glasses here, filled with different levels of liquids, with a monochord, and there's he's hung weights on it there, and with pipes, measuring the pipes. So that's giving him credit for many more experiments than we know he did in Gaffori's Practica Musica, 1492. He was almost as famous for arithmetic as he was for music. Here in Reich's Margarita Philosophica, he's shown as with Boethius as the father of arithmetic and the muse of arithmetic behind them. Boethius and Pythagoras, 1,000 years between them, or 900 years between them. It's astonishing how long this tradition goes on and how solid it is. Solidly it seems to have infused itself into Western culture. In the High Renaissance, in Raphael's School of Athens in the Vatican, and nobody's quite sure which is Pythagoras, but he's got to be there. Some say he's the person writing, though he's not known to have written any books, but who knows. And others say he's the cloaked character on the right. Take your pick. But think of Pythagoras' presence in the Florentine Renaissance. Ficino, including the Pythagorean golden verses in his anthology of the essential works of Neoplatonism and theurgy. Think of Pico della Mirandola with his 900 theses, which have these very gnomic Pythagorean sayings. Think of Francesco Giorgi, author of the Harmonia Mundi, who combines Pythagorean mathematics with Kabbalah, and who helped to design the Church of San Francesco della Vigna in Venice, which is all based on figure 9. Pythagoreanism is at the center of this movement, even if it doesn't appear as such, because as I said, all the Platonism and Neoplatonism is infused with Pythagorean thinking. Picturesque Pythagoreanism. There's the Pythagorean Y, again. If you go up the broadside, it leads to swords, whips, birches, manacles, the gallows, and the fire. If you go up the narrow one, it leads to laurels, palms, books, the distaff, and the crown. I suppose the distaff is what women get, and the book is for the men. From this very strange book about how to design the Roman letters, giving each of them a symbolic meaning. In the Florentine Intermedi, a great musical performance in 1589 for the wedding of Ferdinando, the representation of the singing spheres, the harmony of the spheres, shown by the sirens all around the spindle of necessity. This enacts the scene at the end of Plato's Republic, the vision of Ur. And in a fountain design, a fountain driven by its own water, with this mechanism that turns the wheel and makes the smiths seem to bang on their anvil, no doubt. Tones. Bah, 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 bah. Picturesque Pythagoreanism and occult Pythagoreanism, because in all of this we've rather forgotten his occult and divinatory side, his shamanistic side. But from the Middle Ages they had a form of divination called the Pythagorean wheel, in which you ask a question, you turn it into figures, and then it tells you whether you're going to live or die. That's again from Robert Flower. It could be, yes. It could be wrong too. Pythagoras and science now. Kepler. Some of these are so well known I won't spend much time on them. But here's Kepler taking the Pythagorean idea that the planets are organized according to a harmony. First of all, to explain their distances, the distances of their orbits, by inserting the five regular solids between them. There's the inner ones, and there's the outer ones, with the cube separating Saturn from Jupiter. Each of these could be a lecture in itself. Newton, a Pythagorean despite himself, who is the one who pointed out the fallacy in Pythagoras' weighing of the hammers. Newton said, if you hang the hammers on the strings, you want to get those tones, they have to be as the squares of the numbers, not the numbers 6, 8, 9, 12. It has to be the squares of those numbers, from which Newton deduced that the Pythagoreans had known the inverse square law of gravitational attraction, and that they'd hidden it as a fallacy in the story, which, as Newton said, any fool would try it and see that it was false, and then would discover the true numbers. And from those, would deduce that gravity works according to the inverse square, according to the squares of the distances. And although he was a great experimental scientist, he was also compelled to analyze the spectrum by a desire to make it fit the diatonic scale. You know what a spectrum looks like. It looks like a rainbow. How many colors are in the rainbow? Well, only Newton decided that there had to be seven. And he decided there were seven because they had to fit the notes of the scale. You ask any artist, and the artist will have say, what is indigo? No artist worries about indigo. It's a Newtonian invention. But it fills out the sacred number of seven. Pythagoras somewhat into decline in the 18th century. Here he is in the last great compilation in Stanley's History of Philosophy. But he survives in Freemasonry. Freemasonry in this emblem shows somebody working in ancient Egypt with the Pythagorean theorem here, observing the heavens, using mathematics to construct architecture. And Pythagoras suddenly has a prominent role to play in Freemasonic lore. And that seems to have kept his reputation going through the Age of Reason. I'm accelerating a bit now because I must get to the end of my story. And how long do I have? Are we supposed to stop at 10:15? A long disquisition on Pythagorean principles and Pythagorean life, showing how they really were the best way of understanding both metaphysics and ideal society. From those, Fabre d'Olivet deduced his three principles of providence, will, and destiny, which he uses to explain really the workings of all of history and the workings of the human being. This is again one of those other stories, but we had to commemorate him for bringing Pythagoreanism into an esoteric synthesis in the Napoleonic era, because he was also the translator of the first books of the Torah in, let's say, a Platonic mode or a metaphysical mode. And for him, the two things were both about the same metaphysical realities expressed by Moses in the Torah, expressed by the Pythagoreans, expressed also because he now had access to the writings of India and Persia. Thanks to the English scholars, he had access even to some of the Nordic writings, the Eddas. And I think he was one of the first to make a grand synthesis that wasn't dominated by Christianity. Before him, you had people like Athanasius Kircher, but for Kircher, everything had to fit Christian doctrine. He was a Jesuit, he had no choice. But for Fabre d'Olivet, he cut loose. He was a sort of free-floating metaphysician. And for him, Pythagoras and Moses were the clearest exposers of this metaphysics. And then towards the end of his life, he started the Pythagorean, an esoteric group, a sort of fringe Masonic group, using the imagery of agriculture rather than architecture, which was very secretive and was his own way of having a secret school, which has always been what Pythagoreans have done Thomas Taylor, contemporary of Fabre d'Olivet, does much the same for England. He translates the Neoplatonic corpus into English, just as Ficino had translated it into Latin at a time when any educated person could read Latin. Thomas Taylor is writing for anybody who can read English. And he translates the works of Plato, Proclus, Aristotle, Plotinus, and all the other Neoplatonists. He too makes a compilation called The Theoretic Arithmetic of the Pythagoreans, which must be the first book since the Renaissance to try to assemble all the Pythagorean teachings about arithmetic, symbolic arithmetic. Thomas Taylor is read by the transcendentalists in America, Emerson, Thoreau, Alcott, and passes with them into some of the early theosophists. Blavatsky read Plotinus and Proclus in Taylor's translations. He passes it to Yeats, The Golden Dawn. They all read Taylor. It comes later in the 20th century to an interesting group called the Shrine of Wisdom, who reissue a lot of the Platonic works in the 1940s and 50s. And then Kathleen Rae, the founder of the Semios Academy in London, which is an institution some of you may have had to do with. Kathy Ring is a tremendous admirer of Thomas Taylor. She said to me once that she's known as a poet, but really, those who know her better know her as a Blake scholar, and those who know her best of all know her as a Thomas Taylor scholar. So for her, this was really the royal road to wisdom, was through Thomas Taylor and through the Neoplatonists. Mercurio, rather not so well known, but I just pick him out of a bunch of Pythagoreans from the middle of the 19th century, from the era of Eliphas Levi and the beginning of the occult revival. He's a priest who writes a massive work in the 1840s called The Harmonies of Being, Les Harmonies de l'Etre, in which he tries to reconcile Platonic ideas of harmony with the Christian doctrine. And it includes, rather like Philo did, to reconcile the Torah with Platonism in the first century BC. La Courrier is doing it with Christian doctrine. But he also participates in the whole theory of correspondences, showing how the tones, the seven tones, the seven colors, the seven virtues, all the sevens in Christian arithmology can be aligned. And like Pythagoras, he approaches the universe as a harmony. He doesn't, he's not concerned with so much with good versus evil. He's concerned with seeing the universe as a divinely ordered whole in which we are intended to be happy, I suppose. La Courrier is read by the French occult people like Saint-Yves d'Alvedre, like Papus, and the rest of them. And he's also read in Brazil. Now, I don't know much about this, but this Dario Belotfo founded a Pythagorean order, a temple, mainly through his study of Fabre d'Olivet and the French occultists, who avidly read in Brazil under the emperor, under the empire of Pedro II. And there it stands in Curitiba. Maybe some of you have been there. Have you been there? Maybe that's a place for an esoteric rest. It's astonishing. The Neo-Pythagorean in Brazil working to this day. Amadeo Amentano, we only have these few pictures of these gentlemen. Amentano grew up in Brazil and was introduced to this Pythagorean current as a boy. He came to Italy, and by the time he was 18 or 19, he was quite an expert in Neoplatonism, Pythagoreanism, and an aspirant to theurgy. And he met the much better known Arturo Righini, and between them, they founded a Pythagorean school. Righini was a Freemason. He was a pagan, a neo-pagan. He wanted to revivify Freemasonry and turn it from just being a social club or a left-wing organization into being an initiatic organization again. He wanted to, bring it back to its Pythagorean roots. So the two of them, they founded a Pythagorean rite. I can't remember the exact names of them. And right into the fascist era, Righini had hopes that Italy would turn back to Pythagoras, would turn back to true Freemasonry, would turn back to the ideals of the Renaissance and the Risorgimento instead of continuing its kowtowing to the Pope. He was quite anti-Catholic, and he wrote a strongly worded treatise called Imperialismo Pagano, Pagan Imperialism, arguing that a true empire should be based on these kind of principles. He didn't flourish after the fascists made their peace with the church, of course. He lost his job as a mathematics teacher and passed the rest of his life in obscurity, but still writing treatises on Pythagorean mathematics and and Freemasonry, that too was banned under the fascists. He collaborated with Evola, Julius Evola, on the Grupo de Ur's work. He's one of the main contributors to their writings on magic, which came out under anonymous names as Ur and Krua. That's another story. Giuliano Crema is another Italian. He was more interested in the therapeutic and theurgic aspects of Pythagoreanism. And he too, at the beginning of the 20th century, founded a fraternity, Fratellans Neo-Magica de Milia, I think it was called, which unusually included women. Freemasonry, as you know, does not. But like some fringe Freemasonries, Cremers' order included women. Not too much is known about it. Some offshoots of it exist today. Probably the best access to it is through a journal called Politica Romana, which is run by a sort of Cremensian disciples. You had to find out about him for yourselves if you're interested in him. He's a very fascinating character. But I'm just sowing seeds that some of you may find worth following up of these late Neo-Pythagoreans. And then if we turn to Germany at the same time, Albert von Timus, a member of the Prussian Parliament and a jurist, spends his free time writing this absolutely terrifying book called De Harmonicalis Symbolicis Altitudes, The Harmonic Symbolism of Antiquity, which bases itself on the Tetractes, seen as the overtone series and the undertone series and all the notes in between, and interprets this as the key to the I Ching, the key to Egyptian mathematics, the key to the Torah, the key to just about everything. And I can't claim to have read more than a fragment of the book. It's one of these monsters of erudition and one of these things that some really superior mind has to absorb and then put together with Ernest MacLean and John Michener and all the other people who've had these universal aspirations growing out of Pythagoreanism. But more comprehensively, and I think this is the end, we have Hans Kaiser, who takes the Landamer, who takes this development of the Tetractes with the subharmonic series, the harmonic series, I'm sorry for these musical terms, projects them onto the monochord and develops an entire musical metaphysic and philosophy out of them. Hans Kaiser's work, Lehrbuch der Harmonik, 1950, which my son has translated into English for the Institute of Sacred Science, is, I think it's the great work of musical Pythagoreanism of the 20th century. And if you understand music, I think you have to understand music theory to read it. It's a very illuminating work. So the tradition continues in these various places, and I suppose it continues in this room. And that's probably where we should leave it. So we have time for a few questions, if there are any. Yes, sir.
I'm interested in Pythagorean the tradition of his interest in reincarnation. And I was just wondering more specifically whether there is anything in his teaching that corresponds with the Eastern concept of karma going along with reincarnation.
I don't believe it is. Except in as much as in Plato, when Plato takes it over, people choose their incarnations according to the wisdom or unwisdom that they developed in previous lives.
Yes.
That's which is a bit different.
I didn't realize that was in Plato.
It's in at the end of the myth of Ten of the Republic.
Yes.
He sees these people picking their next lives, and one picks the life of a tyrant who becomes immensely rich, and he doesn't read to the end of the story and finds that he's going to be crucified. So that's the closest it comes. But none of them seem to go into the intricacies of reincarnation, because the whole question is, what exactly is it that reincarnates?
Yes.
And as I've heard a Buddhist say, thinking of Pythagoras, say, remembering his incarnations, I remember my past lives, but are they mine? What does mine mean? It's something that's usually treated too superficially, even by Pythagoreans, I think.
Yes. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes.
When was the Y, the split the right hand from the left hand? When did that develop?
The Pythagorean Y, I think that must have been in people like Theon of Smyrna, no, the later Pythagoreans, probably around the 2nd century BC, and I'm not sure who first talks about it. Why?
Because it seems like wisdom for Pythagoras was universal, it's universal friendship, and you did mention the word philosophia.
I didn't.
Philosophy.
I forgot.
And is
he was the first
friendship.
To call himself a philosopher.
Thank you.
Yes, and friendship. Yeah.
So when it became split, Aristotle divided wisdom into practical wisdom and higher wisdom. And so it seems like the split was a later, possibly, I don't know if you could speak to that, but it seems to be divided, whereas Pythagoras considered it universal wisdom. Because if you will, it's friendship, it's not erotic, it's not love, mm-hmm. it's love in the sense of friendship. So I just wonder.
I think I can only say that everybody makes their own developments in Pythagoreanism. And you make this one, you could probably find some Pythagorean who would confirm it. Whether it's Pythagoras himself, I don't know. And whether Aristotle is really transmitting Pythagoras' ideas, or whether they are those of people who are 100 years later who are already developing them, I don't know. But you're right in saying that the idea of wisdom, Pythagoras's ideal is always to bring the opposites into harmony rather than split them.
But, if there's no more questions, I was just wondering if you could speak to the division of the calendar in relationship to zero, because it seems to negate this blossoming of genius that happened at the beginning, that you mentioned at the beginning of your talk. Zero wasn't introduced by the Arabs, and the imposition of the zero seems to separate the fascism of Christianity from the wisdom tradition that flowered before zero. So I'm curious about that division of the calendar in relationship to the development of the wisdom tradition.
Oh, I don't know anything about that, too, except that Hans Kaiser and Fontimus make a big deal of zero. And the fact that beyond the Pythagorean table, it's always assumed that there's zero, and that's the unmanifest. It's beyond being, it's what Plotinus calls beyond being, and the Pythagorean Tetractus is all about being. But there's a whole other realm of possibilities of non-manifestation.
Okay, because it seems like a negation, when we created zero,
yes.
It's like a negation of the wisdom tradition prior to the fascism. That's my term.
Okay. Yes.
Where
it's
the religion.
Yes. So, did you have a question? Did I see another hand come up? No. Yes?
I'm wondering if I'm thinking of the right person, but did Pythagoras supposedly form a community?
Yes, I didn't say much about it, and about how it had women as well as men, and how it had different layers, and how you had to observe 5 years of silence before you were admitted to. Yeah, he did. He was the first utopian community.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
been intrigued with the opposites that you listed and call them complementary, and then some relationship here with karma. If you look at karma as balance, when you're out of balance, you need to go back to balance. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at that chart there, when the opposites are out of balance, you're coming back into your own balance.
Yes, so.
So I think that's quite a relationship with karma, depending mm-hmm. the yin and the yang, the karma out of balance, natural law. I think it all ties together.
And they cancel out, don't they? And it comes to zero. Well, any more questions, or do you want your coffee? One more question.
Just a quick question about this community, and I know you didn't go into it a lot, but he was banished in medical where he died.
Yes.
And it was for purely political reasons, or was it because this community didn't have control?
Oh, I think so. He was getting too much control. He got on the wrong side of the city fathers. It's rather like the Mormons, you know, they got chased from place to place, they got persecuted, but they got too powerful. Interesting. Yeah. Well, yes.
One more question about Pythagoras' presence in Babylon and what is known about that, his connection with the Magi. He was brought there by Cambyses' army, I believe. But as far as what he was taught there and what he learned.
What he learned in Babylon? Well, astronomy,
the Magi astronomy,
mathematics. And the Babylonians were way ahead of the Greeks, weren't they? Until Pythagoras brought something of theirs and something of Egyptian mm-hmm. mathematics to Egypt. Yeah, I would say astronomy most of all, but also calculation.
Did they have their own interpretation of the name Sophos?
Did they
have their own interpretation of the name Sophos, of
Sophos,
Sophia?
Or Sophia. You mean wisdom? I can't have it up in my head. I'd have to work that out. No doubt.
Where the name came from.
Significant numbers, yes. All the Greek gods' names were listed to be numerically significant. Well, I think we have to draw a...